Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Fertility and Sterility On Air. We're live from the Pacific Coast Reproductive Society meeting. I'm Micah Hill, the media editor of FNS, and I'm here with my co-host of FNS On Air, Kate Devine. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Micah. I certainly can't complain about being here at beautiful PCRS, and I hope some of you listening were able to be here too, but if not, we'll get you the highlights here this morning.
So, Kate, why don't you introduce us to our first speaker that we've heard some great research from this week?
Absolutely. We're here with a fellow from EVMS who was our first prize winner at this meeting. So congratulations to Dr. Ariel Yeshua and her co-author and mentor from RMA New York, Philip Romansky. Ariel, thank you so much for being with us this morning. Can you tell us a little bit about your study and what the findings were?
Thank you guys so much for having me. This is crazy opportunity, and I'm super excited to be here. So basically, the objective of our study was really to determine the proportion of euploid and truly diploid embryos within a cohort of abnormally fertilized embryos defined by zero and one-pin embryos at the morphologic assessment. Our hypothesis really was that a good portion of these embryos would actually be euploid and truly diploid, and therefore usable embryos, with the thought process being that about 10% of all zygotes made are abnormally fertilized, and about 20% of those will go on to the blastocyst stage. And there are a good portion of these embryos that we're just discarding that we could be using to help patients achieve a pregnancy.
So tell us a little bit about the testing that you did to make sure that these truly are normal. I think I've read some case reports of abnormally fertilized embryos that led to molar pregnancies or triploidy. So what did you do in your testing to really make sure that you were detecting any potential abnormalities in these embryos?
Yeah, so I think our study is the largest to date looking at these abnormally fertilized embryos. The first step was to go through PGT-A with next generation sequencing, which we do to test for aneuploidy most of the time. But then we took that one step further. And so all the embryos that came back as euploid then underwent this STR or short tandem repeat analysis. Basically, what STRs are short sequences of nucleotides that are repeated multiple times, usually about 2 to 6 nucleotide base pairs long, and they're only found on exons. And these STR markers are highly polymorphic, meaning between individuals, the number of repeats will vary greatly at each loci. And so a normal diploid cell would have two different alleles at each marker indicating diploidy. If you see homozygous across the board, so you only have one allele at each marker, that's indicative of haploidy.
That's great. And about how many embryos were you able to look at, Ariel?
In total, we had 432 zero and one-pin embryos, and over half of those, 225, were actually euploid and diploid, so usable embryos.
That's great. So obviously, the clinical implications here are that we are increasing the number of usable embryos for these patients and hopefully increasing their overall cumulative live birth rate. I'm just curious as to how did that match up in terms of what you would have expected based on maternal age? Would you say that you would consider these embryos to have the same reproductive potential as those noted to be 2PNs? And if so, how do you explain that? Why have we been discarding these embryos all this time?
Yeah. So I think the euploidy rate, given our average maternal age was around 36, is actually pretty consistent with what we see for 2PN embryos. I think there are inherent limitations in our fertilization check. And so it's potentially possible that we're just missing the appearance of the pronuclei at the fertilization check. And so these are usable embryos. We're just not catching them.
That's great. Thank you. So Philip, as the senior author, what's the main take-home point for our audience and what are the next steps in this research for us to feel confident with transferring these embryos?
So I think the main overall take-home point here is that for labs that are discarding or not transferring 0PN and 1PN embryos, it does appear that a portion of these are usable embryos. And so if we have this technology, we can test these embryos and confirm that they are euploid, they are diploid. There is this ability to increase the number of overall usable embryos per retrieval cycle for patients, which at the end of the day is going to increase the cumulative live birth rate for these patients. Next steps for this particular project is more long-term, looking at the actual transfer outcomes from these embryos as we begin to collect that data as time goes on. So we're really looking forward to adding that as another level of confirmation about the viability of these embryos.
So I do really think this is an important and clinically impactful study. So congratulations again. One more question sort of in the other direction from how do you validate these embryos is, at this point, would you feel comfortable transferring a PGTA untested embryo that was a 0 or 1PN at FERT check?
I think there are labs that certainly will do this. I think it requires additional patient counseling on some of the potential risks transferring an embryo that appears abnormally fertilized. At this point, with this available technology to confirm the ploidy of the particular embryo, I think it would be best to recommend that testing in these cases before transferring the embryos.
But I do think that opens up a discussion about whether or not we really need a fertilization check and what that information is telling us. And using these other technologies, I think we can maybe potentially avoid kind of doing that fertilization check and extra handling of embryos.
Great point. And thank you again so much.
Congratulations on your research. And please submit this to Fertility and Sterility so we can publish it there. This is something that I think all of our readers are very interested in. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So we're so fortunate to have with us today Dr. Kristin Brogard, who is the co-founder and chief scientific officer of Inherent Biosciences. And she is our second prize award winner at PCRS this year. So congratulations, Kristin. Thank you for being with us. And could you please tell us a little bit about your study and your findings?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. So we are solving a problem in non-obstructive azoospermia. Non-obstructive azoospermia, and how we're defining it, is when you do not have any sperm in the ejaculate and there's no known obstruction. This affects 1% of men worldwide and about 10 to 15% of men who are going through fertility treatment. Right now, there are amazing technologies like microtesticular sperm extraction that allows for us to really remove sperm from the testicle in order to perform an ICSI procedure. Unfortunately, that procedure is really invasive. So you essentially fillet the testicles open and search for sperm in the testicle, and it's a very invasive and a hugely expensive procedure. And in most all cases, it's not covered by insurance. And that would be good if it got sperm in most cases, but 50% of those procedures fail to find sperm. And physicians right now, and primarily reproductive urologists, are really, it's a coin flip of if they're going to find sperm or not in the testicle. So patients are making these decisions without a lot of information to help guide their decision, and they know they have a very intensive procedure in front of them. So what we were hoping to do was develop a non-invasive, very accurate way to predict the likelihood of sperm in the testicle. And what we're doing is, and our goal is, to use DNA methylation to identify if DNA came from sperm. So that's really what we're trying to do. And what we have found is that sperm DNA methylation patterns are extremely different than somatic or non-sperm DNA methylation patterns. So you can actually use a DNA methylation pattern on a DNA strand to identify if it came from sperm or not. And we can use that to say, if we look at cell-free DNA in the seminal plasma, what's the likelihood of sperm being in the testicle? Because cell-free DNA is released when natural cells die or disease cells die. And if there is low concentration of this sperm-derived DNA in the seminal plasma, our hypothesis is that there wouldn't be much sperm in the testicle. So our study, which is now totally funded by the NICHD, which we are very thankful for, we analyzed testicular biopsies to see if we could identify that if we look at the DNA methylation patterns in the testicle, if it predicted the biopsy result. We saw that was correct. We then were able to identify cell-free DNA of semen in the seminal plasma. And now we have a little over a dozen semen samples from men with non-obstructive azoospermia, and so far have had a statistically significant ability to predict the likelihood of sperm in the testicle. So we're really excited. There's lots more work to do.
This is such a cool study, and congrats on your NICHD funding. That's great. So I know prior literature has looked at things like to predict this testicular volume, I think FSH, sometimes testosterone levels, and they try to come up with predictive algorithms, but I don't think they're the success of those. You know, it's better than a coin flip, but it's certainly not 90, 95%. How accurate do you, I know you're still working on sample sizes to get there, but how accurate do you think this test has the potential to be in its predictive ability?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of those additional tests are really helpful for maturation arrest, which is something that we haven't tackled yet. Currently, we are 100% negative predictive. So when there is zero cell-free DNA derived from sperm in the semen, we have never seen yet testicular sperm extraction work. So, but when you start to get into the positive predictive value, that's where we're losing a lot of sensitivity. And that's where maturation arrest actually becomes a big question. So that's, we've actually redone our technology platform to start to get single molecule level reads so we can start to maybe get more predictive in that positive predictive value. But negatively, right now, we're seeing very consistent prediction.
Obviously, huge clinical potential here for helping to stratify these patients and who should undergo this, as you say, invasive and expensive procedure. So I know you mentioned 100% negative predictive value for this test. How many patients did you have that had zero cell-free DNA in the seminal plasma who then, obviously, all of them then went on to have an unsuccessful microtussy?
Yeah, that's the key question right now. Our numbers are too low to make big claims, but we have... It's been, I think, over, we're at like about a dozen semen samples, and I would say half of those have had negative extraction, but we're nowhere near having this to be have clinical utility because this is something you have to get right. And I'm very sensitive to that. I don't want to present results that telling a man that he can't have a biological child and take that lightly. So we have a lot more work to do to see if the consistency of that negative predictive value.
Yeah, so that's a great point and great segue. You don't want to take that opportunity away. It's pretty weighty. But to the clinical utility that you mentioned, you know, tell us a little bit just about how this test could transition to a clinical test. What does the specimen handling look like? Is this, you know, how practical is this?
Yeah, the great question. That's actually the beauty of this test is that it's really, really robust in the way that we can just get and how we're doing it right now with collecting semen samples for this. We just take the remaining part of a semen sample that's been collected where they've been diagnosed with NOA. It gets put into a screw top tube and gets sent directly to our lab. There's no preservative. We can, just because we're looking at cell-free DNA, it's actually very, very stable. So the process is really easy. And I have kind of dreams about where I want this to go. And my goal, and actually what we wrote into our grant, is that we're going to include Y microdeletions and Klinefelter's analysis within this same semen sample. So my goal would be for in an REI clinic, not just in a reproductive urology clinic, this could be a reflexive test for any azoospermic man. And ideally, and this is where I would love to go, is we could actually pellet it and see if it's cryptospermia. To see if there's sperm in the pellet. Look in the seminal plasma to see the likelihood of testicular sperm extraction success, and then also get the etiology with our genetic testing. So I would love it to be a comprehensive test for all azoospermic men.
That's great. And I can definitely see a world where this is combined with other of the modalities that Micah mentioned, and there may even be some others coming down the pike as well to really increase that predictive potential. So thank you again so much for being with us and congratulations. And we look forward to, you know, the full large sample to help us use these data. We're fortunate now to have here with us Shulin Tsai. She's one of the fellows from Cornell and was the recipient of the Faring ASRM grant last year for her fellowship research, which was called Generation of Artificial Oocytes, Somatic Cell Haploidization of Mouse Endometrial Stromal Cells and Bone Marrow Mesenchymal Stem Cells. So congratulations, first and foremost, Shulin, for obtaining this funding and for having such a productive year. Everyone really enjoyed your presentation here at the meeting yesterday. Tell us a little bit about the study.
Thank you so much for having me. So I'm very excited to have presented this study on for my thesis. So as we know, millions of people are affected with infertility, and we as REIs have the fortune of helping a lot of people build their families. But we do have limitations. For example, people that do not have any oocytes, their only real option is to do donor eggs. But in the future, if we were able to develop artificial oocytes that are viable and safe, that would be the ultimate solution to female infertility. And so that's kind of the concept behind our study, to see whether or not we can make a viable artificial oocyte.
It's such a great problem to try to tackle, and certainly something we've seen many people attempt before, and even companies and startups come and go trying to solve this. So what were the biggest technical issues, that challenges that you faced, and how, what was the route that you took specifically to try to make this successful where others have not been able to?
Exactly. So this has been tried in many, many different ways. And so the approach that we took was specifically somatic cell hybridization through somatic cell nuclear transfer. And this is a concept of how we're taking a somatic cell, so something like an endometrial cell or a bone marrow mesenchymal stem cell, taking a somatic cell that's a diploid and turning it to a haploid cell, which only has one set of chromosomes and is characteristic of oocytes. And to do this, we used the intrinsic machinery that's already present in an oocyte and that functions to reduce the ploidy in an embryo just through the natural process of meiosis. And so by utilizing the ability of the oocyte to undergo meiosis to then reduce the number of chromosomes that are in a cell, that's how we decided to approach creating a artificial oocyte.
That's really amazing. And so tell me a little bit more about, you know, how this machinery can function in terms of the actual nuclear transfer that you did. Tell us, you know, when you transfer the nucleus, what happens next within the cell to result in the haploidization?
So we all know in meiosis, our oocytes are arrested in prophase one. And then when it undergoes the LH surge, the homologous chromosomes separate and segregate. And that's the action of reducing the cell from a diploid to haploid. So instead of having the oocyte segregate its own chromosomes, we actually remove the genetic material of the oocyte. So now it's only a shell, but it still has all its intrinsic machinery. And we replace that with our somatic cell. So we do our somatic cell nuclear transfer, replace it with the genetic material that we want, and then allow the oocyte to then undergo this process of haploidization to then turn that diploid into a haploid.
So all our listeners are dying to know, tell us the results. What happened? Were you able to successfully do this? And how far down the line were you able to go with it?
So yeah, it was really exciting, our results. So we use two different donor cell lines. We use endometrial stromal cells and we use bone marrow mesenchymal stem cells to for the somatic cell haploidization process. And we looked at how many of these will develop into blastocysts. So one classic issue with any sort of technique, and especially this technique, is that you get very high attrition rates. And our attrition rates, while a little high, were a lot better than our previous results, such that we were getting about a 17% blastocyst rate in the previous cumulus cells that people were performing with their experiments. Now we're getting a 28% blastocyst rate for our endometrial stromal cells, and we're getting about a 23% blastocyst rate for our bone marrow mesenchymal stem cells.
That really is quite impressive, especially in light of all of the technical aspects of this procedure and the results that have been reported previously. What are your next steps? So these were mouse embryos, obviously. Where do we go from here, and how is this going to help our patients going forward?
So our next steps are to evaluate the genetic composition of these embryos. So we want to make sure that the composition of these embryos are euploid. So that's one of our next steps. And the other thing we want to evaluate is the parental contribution of these embryos. Are we getting parental contribution from both the maternal side as well as the paternal side? Because we definitely want to have a biparental embryo.
Well, it's a huge accomplishment. And, you know, I understand that you did have not only basically mature oocytes that you formed and then embryos that you formed and then blastocysts that you formed, but even live pups. So tell us, did those pups seem to be normal, these mice that were created in this novel way?
Yes, that was absolutely the most exciting part of the project, waking up and finding, going to the cages, seeing that we have live pups from these embryos. These pups that we obtained did appear to be phenotypically normal. There were no obvious abnormalities that we can tell from just visually inspecting them. And they've grown up to be great. They've actually grown up. We've mated them and they're fertile. So, and we're waiting for their babies to grow up and see if they look okay. And we also collected the mouse tails of these mice and these pups so we can do genetic analysis to see if they are indeed euploid and if they indeed have biparental contribution.
That's amazing. Well, we're all on the edge of our seats for this multi-generational study of these mice and to see, again, what you described. So euploidy rates, and then hopefully someday, though probably not someday too soon, when we're all being honest, to see what this looks like in human oocytes.
So we're very honored now to be joined by the president and incoming president of the Pacific Coast Reproductive Society. So we'll start with the president, Tamara Tobias. Tamara, you're only the second nurse practitioner in the very long, illustrious history of this society to be the president. So congratulations. And just tell us about this year and what you're happy for about the Pacific Coast Reproductive Society.
Thank you, Micah. I have to say it's been an incredible year, and it's been such an honor to serve the society. Yes, the second nurse practitioner in 72 years. It's just been a fabulous year, and it's been so great to see how the meeting came to full fruition. I think what's been incredible is we started the meeting a little earlier this year. We started it on Wednesday, and we had a breakout session for APPs and nurses, and we had the highest attendance ever at that meeting. And it was just FAQ, it was networking, but was so great. We were all able to see each other at the beginning of the meeting, get to know each other. We had 35 APPs there and nurses, and now we could meet each other throughout the meeting. So it was just such a great opportunity to do this. And it's been such an honor to serve PCRS this last year. Thank you.
That's great. And, you know, as a field, I know we're all working hard to make sure that we have long and fulfilling and collaborative careers for our APP colleagues. So I think that the field and the society are incredibly well served to have you at the helm over this last year and your ongoing leadership. Other than what sounds to have been a great kickoff for the APP contingent, what highlights were there for you at the meeting this year?
I feel that the program planning committee did a fabulous job of putting together the schedule. The speakers have been just fantastic. I think my favorite part was listening to all the oral abstracts. It was just fascinating to see the science coming and the fellows, and it was just so much engagement and what I learned. And so I feel like that was my favorite part of the meeting, with the oral abstracts.
So Alex, we'll go to you at the conclusion of the meeting. I guess tonight you'll become the president of PCRS, and obviously standing on the shoulders of giants like Tamara. You and I are the same fellowship year, but I think you've been coming to PCRS for a lot longer than I have. So what got you involved in PCRS, and what are you going to do as president of our wonderful society?
Thank you, Micah. And first of all, thank you for having us and giving us the exposure to talk about this wonderful meeting and this wonderful society. So PCRS has always been like very near and dear to me ever since I first came here in 2011. So at USC, where I was a fellow, it was sort of like standard that we would present at PCRS and ASRM every year and that we would attend. And so the first time I ever came to this meeting, I was sort of blown away by this intimate collegiality, which is supposedly the spirit of the organization. So it's the setting here in the beautiful Palm Springs area is very conducive to collaboration, for people to hang out professionally and socially, for networking. The size of the meeting is also such that people really get to know each other. And over the years, like ever since that first year where I came and I just fell in love with the meeting and the organization and actually won an award, and that of course helped to like keep coming here and get more involved. And I was program director over the years, but this setting here allows people to really exchange ideas in a very collegial way, and also maybe in a non-threatening way. Like, for example, fellows that present here, they might not be sort of asked the same like tough questions or like be like roasted in a sort of, you know, hostile manner, but it's more like a collegial discussion. Obviously, we exchange ideas, and sometimes there are fierce debates. For example, the year I was program director, there was that debate between Richard Scott and Richard Paulson that still people talk about, and that's been repeated multiple years. and that we may actually reproduce for next year, a sneak preview. But basically, I think that it's a meeting where people in a small and relatively collegial setting get to spend time together, exchange ideas. They get to see each other's kids grow up over the years. And so it's great for networking, great for fellows. We have fellow receptions, networking events. We have grants and scholarships. So I think it's just a great organization for professionals and especially also for trainees.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's not 14 PCRS meetings for me. It's only three so far, but I'm among the many of us here who come once and are completely hooked. So we look forward to your leadership over this next year. And thank you for this great experience that you give all of us. We'll never miss a meeting. We're fortunate to be here today with Rachel Mandelbaum, a fellow from USC, who presented a very novel study here at the meeting as an oral presentation. Rachel, thank you so much for being here. And please tell our audience about your project on needle-less or needle-free IVF.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me here. So our project looked at using a subcutaneous catheter for administration of the medications for ovarian stimulation. And it's really just a different route of administering the injections that we commonly use as part of ovarian stimulation with the hopes of making IVF a little bit more palatable, a little bit less burdensome for patients who are already experiencing so many emotional and physical stressors of the IVF process. And we specifically looked at how patients experienced using the catheter, making sure it was feasible and effective. And then we looked at FSH, serum FSH levels, and compared them between patients who were using the catheter versus those who used needle injections and found no significant differences. So really exciting data, I think, to, you know, do a small thing to improve this process for patients.
So your primary outcome was serum FSH concentrations post-injection. How did you choose that primary outcome, and what gave you the confidence to believe that the concentrations would be similar among those patients who had this indwelling subcutaneous catheter versus those that were having subcutaneous injections as is done typically?
Yeah, so we chose FSH as the primary outcome because ovarian stimulation is actually a unique process in that the pituitary is downregulated. So everything that we are giving subcutaneously, we should see in the serum. There shouldn't be this confounding of pituitary FSH. And it's different even from the literature out there using the catheter, where, for example, they gave insulin. And there is data out there that looks at insulin levels, but most of the time the endpoint will be glucose, which is sort of the secondary indirect marker of giving insulin. But for us, we can actually monitor FSH. And so we can be very confident that what we are giving subcutaneously is actually all reaching the plasma or serum in patients undergoing ovarian stimulation. And then I actually have some personal experience using the catheter too, which boosted the confidence. So before we started this trial, I used the catheter in my own IVF cycle because I wanted to make sure this wasn't a completely insane idea. And I didn't, I wanted to make sure that it worked on myself before recommending it to other patients. And I found that personally, not only did it work well clinically, because I consider, my IVF cycle a success, but I found that it really did reduce my needle-related anxiety, and I am a self-admitted needle phobe. So I really felt like when it came time for medication administration that night, I felt less anxious 100% than I would have if I had to inject myself, even being a medical person.
So that leads perfectly into the next question. I assume you measured patient comfort, patient satisfaction. What did the patients in the study feel that used this new method?
So this was a pilot study, so small numbers of patients, but we found that all patients were satisfied, if not very satisfied, with the catheter. They all said that it eased their fear of needles, eased anxiety during treatment. And then, they all, 100% of patients said that they would recommend it to a friend. And then I think the most telling aspect of our data is that we did have three patients for whom this was a repeat IVF cycle. And all three of them stated that having gone through needles first and then the catheter second, they preferred using the catheter. So I think that you know, the experience of those three patients is really telling that maybe we are actually improving the process here.
And just, I assume that because of the experience with insulin, these things are relatively inexpensive, but from a cost standpoint, what is this adding to the cost of an IVF cycle, just roughly?
So right now, you know, using the catheter is off-label, but it is very affordable. So, you know, depending, the catheter right now is manufactured in Europe, but it's about $10 to $15 per catheter. We used on average 2 to 3 per cycle. So it really is a minuscule amount in the grand scheme of things in terms of what patients are paying for an IVF cycle.
So that's interesting. Why did you need more than one for most IVF cycles? Is it a concern about infection, or they fall out, or why do they need to be replaced?
So current data has only used the catheter really up to 7 days. So because this is sort of a novel application of it, we didn't want to stretch that further. And I think anecdotally, by 7 days, you know, people are showering in the catheter, people are doing, I did Peloton workouts every day. You know, people are using this in their daily lives, and I didn't recommend any, you know, you don't need to cover it when you shower. And so I think by 7 days, it's time to change it out. And I think the injection that we're most concerned about is the trigger injection, right? And so we want to make sure that we have a clean new catheter with a good access to the sub-Q compartment for that trigger injection. So we made sure to change it out at least once during the cycle. But if it looks good and a patient wants to keep it in place, I see no reason why, you know, somebody would need to change it out. But I think for the initial studies, we thought it was a good idea. And I will also mention that the catheter is designed for patients to use it themselves. So to insert it themselves at home, to change it out. So, you know, it's easy. A patient takes it out. I usually recommend it about an hour after med administration, and then they can keep it out the full next day until it's time for their next dose.
So you've marched bravely in the footsteps of scientists for generations in terms of self-experimentation here. So thank you for doing that on behalf of our patients and patient experience. What are the next steps here? How are we going to learn more about whether this is a viable treatment modality to be extended more broadly?
I feel confident that the catheter works. I have now approval from our, you know, institutional review board to expand the study to 100 patients. But honestly, I'm going to build a needle-free IVF program because I think that this technology is there ready to be used. And I think patients can really benefit from it. So I'm excited to start that program, to be offering it to patients, and really just put it into clinical use at this point.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for presenting this research here at the at PCRS, and we look forward to seeing this in publication down the road. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you to all of our listeners. This has been a wonderful PCRS, and we just brought you some of the best science that Kate and I saw. We hope you found it as interesting as we did, Kate.
Yes, and please don't forget to like and subscribe to our podcast on all your social media outlets, and to mark your calendar for PCRS next year. We want to see you by the pool.
This concludes our episode of Fertility and Sterility on Air, brought to you by Fertility and Sterility in conjunction with the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. This podcast is produced by Dr. Molly Kornfield and Dr. Adriana Wong. This podcast was developed by Fertility and Sterility and the American Society for Reproductive Medicine as an educational resource and service to its members and other practicing clinicians. While the podcast reflects the views of the authors and the hosts, it is not intended to be the only approved standard of practice or to direct an exclusive course of treatment. The opinions expressed are those of the discussants and do not reflect Fertility and Sterility or the American Society for Reproductive Medicine.